Why so serious?
All the toys, all the time.
I am the game, and still getting trying to play you.
You know the rules. This isn't a toy.
But we bought it at the toy store.
We did, but the way I'm using it makes it an adult thing.
Are you ready to play the game?
Yeah! Welcome to the Toy Department with Matt Kolsky and Derek Madden.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, everybody, it is Toy Department time. I'm Derek Madden. He's Matt Kolsky. How you doing today, man?
Pretty good. Pretty good. I got some Olympic diving on in the background, just keeping an eye on things, you know. The Olympics, like, I don't really care, but also it's a nice thing to have on the television all day long.
Yeah, it's like there's a constant low hum
right.
of things yeah. happening that you could just sort of tune into or check out of.
Right.
It is nice.
And I don't have any attachment to any of it. So, like, if I got something to do, no worries. Just walk directly away from the Olympics. On the other hand, if I'm just sitting around, look at that. There's sports on TV.
I do think that... You know, this is the first Olympics where it's always been true, but this is the first Olympics where it's just nakedly like, look, this is just content. We don't have people here. We shouldn't be doing this.
Yep.
But people needed the content. So here's the content.
Yep.
Would you like to watch the content?
Really, it's the networks needed the content.
Yes,
so here we are. Yeah.
Those are the people I was referring to. Yes.
Right. Not people who are watching. But people who bought and paid for this. And I got to say, like...
Yeah, other people who had financial stakes in this. Advertisers,
right.
The IOC. Those are the people that I mean.
Yeah, and I got to say, like, I think they screwed the pooch. No one has made me understand why this would not have been a better thing to do 1 year from now.
Because there's no reason why it wouldn't have been a better thing to do 1 year from now, other than that it sucks for some people to have to wait. That's kind of the only reason, and given the cost benefit trade-offs there in terms of people's health and safety, like, it's an easy decision, right?
Okay, but let's say we were corrupt assholes who didn't care about health and safety at all, because that's, you know, if we want to understand, we have to try to put ourselves in the frame of mind of the horrifying people that made these decisions. The country doesn't want you there. There's no attendance, so there's a ton of money lost there. I think we've seen, you know, people don't enjoy watching the spectatorless sports as much as they enjoy watching with spectators. So viewership will probably be down. So you're doing this thing to make money now, despite the fact that more money would be available in a year. And if what you're saying is, well, you know, we don't want it too close to the Winter Olympics, it's exactly the same distance from the Winter Olympics right now as it would be a year from now.
I don't think anyone cares about the distance between the Winter Olympics.
Well, I'm just saying, like, I'm trying to think of any ridiculous opposition. And
they,
like,
used to be the same year all the time.
Exactly. Truly, the only issue here is a bunch of rich people could not wait a little longer to cash out. That's it.
Yeah, kind of.
I mean, it's really a shame. All that being said, like, there's a dude spinning around a vault right now, and it's pretty cool.
Yeah. Did you see the big news of the day? I mean, obviously, it'll be probably be a different day by the time people hear this, but with the gymnastics.
I did. Yeah.
Yeah. And, I watched Naomi Osaka last night, like, just sort of dramatically flame out before the quarterfinals of that Olympic tournament. And it does.
Yep.
It does feel like this pressure thing. Is becoming a more prominent issue, I guess is maybe the best way to put it.
I don't know what that means.
You don't know what that means in terms of it happening or in terms of my statement?
Yeah, like, what do you mean the pressure thing is... You're talking... Are you talking specifically about Osaka or in general?
I'm talking about in general. Like, Simone Biles said this was about the pressure of perfection, which is something that she previously had seemed basically impervious to.
So, but I don't understand, why is that different than anything that happened in the past when someone didn't perform under pressure?
Well,
other than the fact that
just say, nah, I'm going to walk away. That's what I feel like is different. Like, we've seen people fail under pressure before.
Well, walked away?
Simone Biles is walking away. Naomi Osaka didn't walk away from the Olympics. Obviously, she competed, but she walked away from two majors this year.
But Simone Biles' career is over, though, right?
What?
Like, Simone Biles didn't quit because the pressure's too much. Her career's over, right?
No. I mean, I don't know if her career's over or not. I don't think she said, I'm retiring, although it's certainly quite possible.
So what do you mean she's – so she didn't leave or anything, did she?
Yes, which she withdrew from the team competition and it may not compete in any of the individual events.
Oh, that I did not see. All I saw was that they had lost something.
Ah, well, okay. Well, that would explain your confusion. Yeah, no, she said, nah, I'm not going to do it.
That's
at least part of the New York Times story I read earlier.
Yeah. Simone Biles.
Biles Team USA's star said she pulled out of the event because she wasn't in the right place mentally to perform the difficult and often dangerous skill she's known for after feeling so much pressure to be successful. Yeah. She had been struggling with the stress of being the greatest gymnast in history, she said, and outside expectations were just too hard to combat.
Interesting. So I guess here's what I'm asking. Is that a change in the way athletes feel and process pressure, or is it a change in feeling like they now have permission to say forget it?
I feel like it's maybe more of the latter. Definitely, yeah. Could be some of both.
I don't think it's the
sensitivity to this stuff and to just mental health in general. You know what I mean?
Again, that's on the back end, right? That's on the back end of, like, it's okay for me to say no if it's not going to affect my mental health positively. And that's fine. I don't have any problem with people pulling out of competition if they don't feel like they're, mentally in the right place to do it. I guess my question is, are we sure this is not just different reactions to similar pressure? Like, are you telling me when Pete Sampras was going for his whatever if Wimbledon title, he didn't feel pressure? Like, I think he did. He didn't quit.
No, I think that's right.
So to me, that's I have no problem with these athletes if they want to not compete because the pressure is overwhelming. On the other hand, I'm not going to celebrate it because at a certain level, it's a failure.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be people fail in sports all the time. It's a totally normal part of sports, but like quitting because you're overwhelmed by the pressure is a failure at a certain level. I mean, I hope it's a personal success, right? But it's a sporting failure. And frankly, like, I'm here to talk about sports. I mean, I guess here we could talk about anything. But in general, like, my job is to talk about sports. And as far as the sport, like, based on what we just read, all right, and again, I had not realized she withdrew overnight. I just knew that they didn't win. So, like, I don't – based on what we've just read, I don't see anything on – I don't see any inappropriate pressure or undue or I don't know. The favorites have pressure. That's sports, right?
Yeah. The pressure is a real part of it. And the other thing is, I mean, look, it's obvious. Like, forcing people to compete who don't want to compete is a non-viable option. Like, of course, it's her life and her choice, and she can do whatever she wants.
Well, and beyond that, I'm not going to call her soft or something, but I mean, it's a fact that she didn't compete because the pressure was too much. That's right.
And the reality is that she is the greatest gymnast of all time.
Right.
And that had she gone out in this Olympics and finished eighth or, you know, whatever, like people, yeah, of course, people would have been disappointed, right? She's the most high-profile athlete at this Olympics.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, sure, people would have been disappointed, but she still would have been considered the greatest gymnast of all time, I'm pretty sure.
Right.
And if not, one of them. So what are we even really talking about here? You know what I mean?
Right. So what is the pressure other than just you want to win? Like, I got to say, like, I'm trying not to be dismissive or insulting, because obviously if it's a choice between competing in an ultimately meaningless sporting event or protecting your own mental health, I think that's an easy choice to protect your own mental health. But I do have to wonder, like, are you protecting your mental health or your feelings? Because I do think there's a difference.
Yep. Yep. I agree. And also, you know, I mean, didn't you work to this for?
Right. I mean, this doesn't,
you know,
this doesn't come around again for you at all. And for the rest of that team, who knows how many of them. I mean, you lost the, like, presumably if she had been there, they'd have won, you know? And I guess that's hard to say, but. Certainly before the Olympics, if I had been like, with Simone Biles, you think Team USA wins the gymnastics? Everyone's like, yeah. And if I go, what if Simone's not there? That's tough.
Yeah. Now, in fairness, she did compete in the prelims and they finished second there. So I don't know that it would have been a lock that they would have won with her. So.
No. But I'm just saying, obviously, that improves their chances. So you're also doing damage to your team. And yeah, like, and I just don't.
She wasn't great for her in the prelims. And she still beat everyone.
I know. So. I saw the prelims, actually. I watched the prelims yesterday. So, yeah, she like was a little off on one of her vaults and landed off to the side, and she still got a higher score than all of her teammates, I think. So,
not just her teammates, everybody. She beat. She was first in the all-around after the prelims. So,
right. So, I mean, yeah. I don't. I don't want to be dismissive of mental health. So. By all means, if that's what she needed to do, then that's what she should have done. But I just think we have to recognize, like, there's a lot of fallout.
Yeah.
And it's just not just for her.
It kind of comes back to the original point of that we shouldn't be doing this in the first place. And the reason we're doing this is essentially content for NBC. And the most valuable piece of that content in terms of, you know, NBC and their viewership and, you know, and all of that. It was just like, nah.
But I do wonder, like, did that affect viewership? Because by the time, like, who even, I don't know.
It's gonna, right? Because people are not watching, right? People are going to watch the gymnastics.
I guess they'll hear she didn't do it and be like, forget it. Why bother?
Yeah. So, and the viewership has not been fantastic. So
yeah,
far,
because
right?
Again, it's weird and bad. And people don't like watching weird and bad stuff as much as they like watching normal stuff. I mean, that's. We've established that, I think, over the course of this pandemic.
Yeah. I don't know. The goofy stuff has kind of been the most fun for me so far, watching, like, random sports. Sure. Have you seen any of the 3-on-3 basketball, by the way?
Yes, it is so bizarre, and I like it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm starting to get why we didn't qualify, maybe. At least, sorry, on the men's side.
Yeah, kind of. Although there's still no excuse. I mean, I don't know who was playing with Robbie Hummel on that team, but, like... Yeah. Robbie Hummel ought to be the best basketball player in the entire world playing 3-on-3. So I don't totally get it.
Yeah. When I heard, though, I just thought it was like the big three or something. But this is – it feels like a whole different sport. You know what I mean?
A little bit. But at the end of the day, like, one great player should be able to own the game.
You'd think. And if right, because there's only two other guys out there.
Yeah. And, like, I will say, though, it moves so fast, and they are really clever with the way they move the ball around. Because, you know, when someone makes a shot, the other guy's just got to get it out of the basket and take it out. Like, take it back to the three-point line. There's no stoppage. Yeah. And so it gets really, like, hectic. And I imagine it would take some getting used to. But I thought that was the whole point of having Team Robbie – play 3-on-3 all year. So I don't know. I will say the Serbian guy that everyone is raving about is hilariously awesome.
I haven't seen this guy yet. I guess I need to.
Yeah, they're just it literally it's a pickup game. So like, there's a real place for the dudes you've met at the park that just like drive you insane by getting awkward buckets all day long. You know what I mean? Like, that can't happen in the NBA, but because of the speed and sort of pickup-y nature of 3-on-3, those guys fit. So like, you're watching like the best pickup players in the world, kind of.
Yeah. What? We should have just recruited down at Rucker Park.
Honestly, I think that would have won it. Except, yeah. I don't know, you know, I don't know how much trouble you'd have with, like, the dribbling rules. But but I do think probably our best 3-on-3 players are, like, non-organized players, you know?
Maybe. Although I can see somebody like Evan Mobley and somebody like that being super good at this.
Yeah, you know, I mean, if you put a 7-footer in there, it'd be really tough.
You need, like, a lean, rangy 7-footer though.
Yeah, they
got
to be able to move a bit, but also like, none of these guys are even 6'5" for the most part. It looks like,
right. So he's gonna get his right. You just throw it down to him, and what are they gonna do?
Yeah, that'd be tough to defend. I would say, yeah.
All right. Let's get to some content because we got a lot of content. We should start with Ted Lasso, right?
Sure. When did you find out that it was only going to be one episode a week?
When I turned it on. So this, all right. So, cause I definitely, to me, it's almost like the headline here, and it shouldn't be because the original first season Ted Lasso was also released this way. It's just nobody had Apple then.
No, it was multiple episodes at a time. I thought it was like three at once.
Oh, it might've been three at once, but it definitely was released in chunks.
Yeah. But that's a big difference. This is not, this show is not a once a week show.
When you got to it, though, it was all there, right? It was all there when you got to it, I'm assuming. It definitely was for me.
Yes. But one is just not enough, man. It's just not enough.
Yeah.
It's 30 minutes of content, and I want 2 hours at least.
I don't know what to do, honestly, going forward. Like, do I just go away for a while and let a bunch of them pile up and try not to hear about it on social media in the meantime?
Well, I just don't know how, like, I guess you might want to be on time for the finale, right? But this does not, to me, feel like a show that, like, we're talking about happenings. I'm not too worried about a bunch of spoilers. You know, and furthermore, this is not, I just don't understand how TV networks or streamers are so confused about what content is what. Like, it seems very obvious to me. There are dramas and even the occasional long form comedy that are talkers week to week. That's not this. That's not what this is about. No one had anything to say 5 episodes into Ted Lasso last year. It's a season, and it's because it's a comedy and it's heartfelt. Like, what we want to do is we all want to bask in the glow of the happiness that Ted Lasso brings us. And I think the way to do that is to dump it. And if not all of it at once, at least in big chunks so we can really sink into it. But like, the whole thing of sinking into the happiness and the joy of the Ted Lasso experience, you can't do that in 27 minutes.
Well, and the first season was so much about this guy, right? Like, winning all these people over time, right? So, and in the binge, right, you could really feel that gradually winning over thing happen. I don't know that that would have worked in the same way week to week as it did. Now, the one defense I can give of this is that I was definitely worried when I thought that it was just going to all drop, that I was going to binge this in like a day and a half and then not have any more Ted Lasso for another 2 years.
Yeah. So that's why I don't think the idea.
Please avoid that. You know what I mean?
So if you went 3-3-3-1 or something like that, or, you know, I don't even know how many episodes are in the season. But if you went in a few chunks, I think I could get down with it. But I got to say, like, one at a time, it's just not enough. So I think I am going to try to let it build up.
Yeah.
And by the way, it's great. It's still great. Ted Lasso's great. It's entertaining. It's funny. It has heart. I love this show. I just wish that I could watch more of it at once.
Yeah, it really knows what it is now.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. It's almost like in the way that the action movie kind of arranges these set pieces. You know what I mean? It knows that, you know, Ted Lasso is going to give an incredible press conference about the dog. And
oh yeah,
it knows that Roy is going to be completely out on this whole double dating thing, except yes. He's going to deliver that one incredible line at the end of it that just gets to the whole point of it, right?
Yeah.
and it nails those moments, completely nails those moments.
The
whole episode's really good. I do, on a personal level, and maybe this is just me as a soccer guy, I do wish that the genesis for needing a sports psychologist for Danny Rojas was a little bit more plausible, you know, a little less outlandish, you know what I mean? Something that might you actually see on a soccer field.
Well, but I think that's the point of, and again, we don't, I think she's a major character, right? So I think we're going to get there, right?
Yeah.
I think the but again, we don't know because it's one episode, but my instinct is we're going to have everybody end up and eventually Ted end up using the sports psychologist so that the more realistic applications of that job will be seen afterwards. I thought the dog thing was funny, and it, you know, you could see it coming from a mile away, but it was still funny. And the guy who plays Danny Rojas is so good. So yeah, I kind of liked it actually.
There were a lot of little. I thought the Love Island ripoff thing with Jamie Tartt at the end too was really great.
Oh my god! Oh my god! It was so good, especially having watched Love Island. He nailed that. The cockiness of it. Just the whole thing was really funny.
It's just the way he's leaned back. Oh man!
Yeah. Yep. Yes. I've seen a lot of overly attractive morons lounged in that chair in exactly that way.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was outstanding. By the way, new season of Love Island streaming on Hulu right now.
All right. Fair enough. look, Ted Lasso is still great. It's still beautiful. This is a pain. I guess the question is, did you like Schmigadoon enough?
Okay, so hold on. Wait, one other thing on Ted Lasso before we turn this podcast into a mess. I had a brain fart and lost it.
Oh,
as soon as you said Schmigadoon, I watched all three stinky episodes of this show. All three godforsaken, garbage-reeking episodes of this show. And I'm here to tell you something. This is not a parody. This is not a comedy. This is just a musical. Stop trying to sell me musicals by saying they're not musicals. It's a musical. And you know what? Because it fancies itself... what's the adjective for parody? Parodical? Because it fancies itself a parody... It's an especially bad musical because the songs are absolute trash. That's how I feel about Schmigadoon. I'll never get that hour and a half back. I don't know why I watched all three. I was hate watching by the third one.
Is this? It can't be an Armisen thing because he's barely in it.
No, I don't care about Fred Armisen at all. I barely noticed him.
Yeah.
It's a bad show. Do you disagree?
I am shocked by this reaction. Yeah. Yeah. I really enjoy it.
Wow.
And
I could not be more shocked by that. Other than one line where Keegan-Michael Key says, I hate musicals. People don't just break out into song. Everything else about this is just a mediocre television musical.
Oh, I don't know about that. I really? Especially as they kind of replay this relationship back in flashback, and you kind of start to understand who, you know, the Keegan-Michael Key and Cecily Strong characters are. I find the people of the town generally – I like – the non-musical parts I like. The songs are goofy enough and short enough that I don't – I'm not generally not bothered by them.
Wow.
And there's a plausible reason for them to be happening. I mean, semi-plausible, right? Talked about this, right? It's my one rule thing, right? I can accept one weird thing, and there is one weird thing in this. They live in this world that is – you know, dictated as a 1940s musical. So when people bring out the song, like, it makes some sense to me. Half the time they're like, this is ridiculous. Sometimes they stop the songs in the right in the middle, like when she's in bed with the you know, the rapscallion guy, and like she just walks out and he like keeps on singing and she just leaves and like throws the bacon in the trash. Like, I don't know. I enjoyed this moment. I'm really shocked that, like, I can see you go, it's not that funny. And whatever. I wouldn't necessarily fight you on that. I don't understand what's hateable about this.
Yeah, no, I mean, I guess you're right. I guess my frustration stems from the fact that, like, I was sold a bill of goods about something that's not a real musical. It's just we're making fun of musicals, but it barely makes fun of musicals, and it's not really funny. So...
Yeah, see, I disagree on both of those points. So I don't know. Yeah, I think we're just in a different place on this
one. It's just one joke making fun of musicals. Like, musicals are dumb. I get it. But why do you have to show me the stupidity over and over again?
Oh, I don't think that is a joke, and obviously it's a running joke, but like
it's the joke.
I don't think it's the joke. I don't think it's the whole show. I think Keegan-Michael Key is really great in this, honestly. And I enjoy the relationship between the two of them. Mm. So, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't.
Like, you didn't like the whole scene where he's like trying to take all those everyone in the town across the bridge? Like, none of that? Did he do anything for you?
No. No, the Kensington feeling or whatever he is.
Yeah, like all of that stuff. Yeah, I don't know.
Nah.
Or like when he's like the girl singing to him, and he's like slowly realizing that she's completely underage, and is like trying to get at it. Like none of that. That didn't make you laugh at all.
No, all right. It really didn't.
Okay. Well, I guess we're just in a different place on that. It's all right, because I'm definitely gonna hate something that you really enjoyed later on.
Seriously, I kind of think like maybe your more considerable hatred of musicals in general means you find the like sort of lightly poking fun at musicals more appealing. I don't know, because I just don't think it's that creative from a parody standpoint.
Oh, really? Yeah, see, I think some of the songs are really good. Like, well done is what I would say. I don't want to say they're good because I, you know, don't enjoy that style of music so much. But, like, in terms of, like, the lyrical parodies and things like that, yeah. Yeah, like, I think they're pretty clever.
Yeah, not really into it.
Yeah, all right, well. We disagree.
Hooray!
And I think we'll leave it at that. Do you want to talk about Woodstock 99?
Yeah. Is this the thing you think I liked and you hated?
No, it's not.
All right. Here's what I would say about this. Really good, really well-made documentary. Very upsetting.
Yeah, all those things are true, yes.
And not just upsetting because, my God, what a travesty. And you can't believe the stuff that the organizers are still saying about it. But... also, just it's sort of a picture of 25 years of societal decay.
Yeah, I do think that they do make that point.
They only explicitly make it at the end, but it's pretty. You feel it the whole time.
You're feeling it exactly right, like that, like this sort of the bacchanalia. The blatant like nihilism of that weekend. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's angry young white men behaving like monsters. And that's more or less how we got to the place in the world that we're at, is angry white men behaving like monsters. And frankly, angry white men with very little reason to be angry.
And this was one of the last of these kind of cultural events that happens without like widespread cell phone usage, right? There's actually a scene of people at payphones, and another scene with like the community message board, and like remember trying to find people at festivals? Like, oh God, it was the worst.
Funny. Here's a funny story. that same year, several months after Woodstock 99's disaster, I went to the biggest festival I've ever gone to. And festival might be the wrong word. It was a Phish concert over 4 days in Big Cypress in Florida in the Everglades. And there were a lot of problems, including the cell phone problem. Me and my friends thought we were being clever by buying some, like, $20 walkie-talkies, which, of course, every single of the, you know, 75 or 80,000 Phish fans had walkie-talkies. Yeah, so you
could. We pulled that move at Coachella once, and it was worthless.
Totally worthless. And so I actually arrived separately from a bunch of my friends because my Nana dropped me off. And once the line hit, which was still a couple miles from the entrance, we were like, don't worry, Nana, just drop us off here. And we hopped out of the car, and she did a U-turn through the median on Alligator Alley to drive home. And then we ended up realizing we were way too far to walk still at that point. So we hopped in a pickup truck with some friendly Canadians who plied us with Molson. And we end up rolling into this place, like me and two pals, with like 15 other friends somewhere on this massive campus. And we tried the walkie-talkies. Nothing was working, to the point where we actually just were like, screw it, it's the three of us for the weekend. We set up our tent, and then we just went to walk around the grounds, and within 7 minutes walked right into our friend's campsite, and we're like, oh my god, we did it. And everything went okay from there. A happy story, if you will.
Yeah, it's funny that you bring up Phish, because Phish performed at that exact same military base, and you know, largely without incident. So,
correct. So what this is, I brought that up for a reason, because I had heat stroke at that concert I'm talking about. I stayed up a little too late, partied a little too hard, slept in a hot tent, and the next morning was dehydrated and vomiting, and the Phish health people got me on my feet and gave me some fluids and had me at the concert that night. And there were no deaths and there was no violence. And to the extent that there was garbage and mud, people, there was no mud really because it was dry. But to the extent that there was garbage, people cleaned it. Concert goers, you know? Yeah. So it's all about the crowd, man. And that's why, to me, it's a little silly for people involved with the organization of this event to look at guys like Anthony Kiedis and Fred Durst and say, you know, they were on stage in the middle of their set and we politely asked them to try to do something about the insane crowd that we failed to control, and they acted like rock stars. How dare they? But I think it would be totally fair to say that the popularity of bands like Korn and Limp Bizkit is something that sociologists and psychiatrists should have been investigating a very long time ago. Because it's not that Fred Durst says break stuff when he's on stage. It's that Fred Durst and Limp Bizkit have been giving angry white kids permission to break stuff for no reason throughout their entire existence.
They made breaking stuff cool.
That's right.
Like, it's, you know, I think the doc did a decent job of showing you exactly that moment was the epicenter of the popularity of Fred Durst, right? Like, there was, and I think it's one of those things now in retrospect, it's hard to remember just how popular they were, but like they sold a million albums in a week. You know?
Oh yeah, they were huge. Like,
it was massive.
And by the way, those people who bought that are late 30s, early 40s, right now trolling people on Twitter.
Some of them. I mean, I thought they did a good job of, right, like you see, you know, talking to some of these modern day concert goers, right? Or not, or, you know, a concert attendees, I should say, right? And you see them now and they're like normal people and embarrassed about,
you know, what
though
they did, I thought, right? There were some dead giveaways that's not quite the case. I thought the one guy who truly seemed upset and regretful is the guy whose friend died. I mean, he was clearly upset, like, and obviously his friend died.
You don't think the guy who was like, I never thought I'd be a person who was in a riot, and like, you don't think he was, you thought he was not genuine?
I thought he was smiling through that whole explanation. I thought he was snickering at his own misbehavior.
Yeah, I read that completely differently. I do think he had a little bit of a grin because I think he was embarrassed.
Oof. Maybe, but to me, that's a guy who knows how to say to a camera staring him in the face that I understand that behavior was inappropriate, and I feel like he got off camera and went to an anonymous Twitter avi and started talking about libtards. Like,
man, that is a cynical reading, but
I think that's a cynical world. You know, and look, I may have read that one guy wrong, but do you doubt that the guy who is trolling people on Twitter could also present less of a horrifying image to a camera? Because, I mean, that's the thing. Most of these people are perfectly capable of appearing like they belong in society, but they don't.
I think most of these people know what happened there was bad. And
exactly.
The promoters, the professional promoters who put the show on were not.
Well,
right?
those guys are a whole other story. Yeah. So, like, I mean, those guys are old and don't understand what they're talking about, and also are in a shocking amount of denial about the disaster that this was. Shocking.
I mean, you can't be less savvy than to be talking about a festival where a number of sexual assaults happened.
Yes.
And there were survivors groups, and blame the women for the way that they were walking around.
Like that
on camera.
He was the one guy who did not understand how to behave on camera.
Yeah. Nothing less savvy than doing that. You know what
I
mean?
Right. Like, I don't know if I believe the younger dudes who probably committed sexual assaults at that event who were on screen, but at least they knew how to perform regret.
I mean, probably committed that's a little bit of a leap, right?
Yeah. I'm being obnoxious, but okay. How's this? I don't know whether to believe the gentleman who may very well have committed sexual assaults at the event. I 100% believe the organizer who doesn't have the good sense to like perform humanity. Like, yeah. I'm staggered by that. Even if you think topless women are begging to be assaulted, like, that's a garbage fire of a thing to believe. But even if you, it's easier for me to understand someone believing that than someone believing they can say it on camera.
Yeah, it is wild, and it's like when you look at this. And by the way, I think it's a credit to this documentary because I think it does a really good job of putting you right back in 1999.
Totally,
like you're living it.
And look, they got really good interviews with really relevant people. Like, I thought, I would have loved to hear from Fred Durst, but otherwise, I thought it was pretty good. Like, there was a good documentary.
I mean, if you're Fred Durst or Metallica or the Red Hot Chili Peppers, like, there's no way you're sitting down for an interview about Woodstock 99, right?
I did very much enjoy. My favorite part of this documentary was Dave Mustaine calling Lars Ulrich a big asshole.
That was your favorite part. I just read. See, maybe I read this more cynically. I just read that as Dave Mustaine, who was also an asshole, just being petty. Right. You know what I mean? Like,
well, but he was right.
Giving his petty Metallica grievances and moving on.
Yeah. Totally. He's being petty. Like, look, I consider the source, obviously. I'm just saying, I also think Lars is a big asshole, so I enjoyed that. I don't have an opinion on Dave Mustaine.
Okay, fair enough.
Dave Mustaine doesn't rate enough for me to care, but Lars sucks, and I enjoy when he is made fun of or talked about as sucking.
Yeah.
I mean, the whole Napster thing, and I get it. And look, in his situation, I guess maybe I would have behaved equally shittily, but like, come on, bro.
Look, none of that was great. I honestly don't think that needed to be in this documentary.
Why it was funny. It was just a chance for Dave Mustaine to call Lars an asshole.
Not just the Dave thing, the whole Napster thing. You know what I mean?
That's what I'm saying. There was no reason for Napster to be there other than for Dave Mustaine to be like, What, you didn't have enough money, Lars?
Yeah, exactly. Right. So,
maybe that was that may have been a condition of Dave Mustaine appearing. Look, I'll do whatever you want if you let me call Lars an asshole in your documentary.
Oh man. Look, this is a really entertaining watch.
It is.
I think it's it says so much about the time, and it says more than you think about this current time.
Yeah.
And I do a good job of making that connection.
Absolutely.
I think it's so perfect that you realize that the fires essentially started because somebody was trying to have a candlelight vigil for Columbine. And that's right. That's what they, they then took that and turned it into this.
That's what these savages did. Yeah.
Kicking down the peace walls,
And by the way, exclusively white men. Exclusively. Yeah. All the violence, all the peace wall destruction, all the fires, exclusively white men.
Wesley Morris, I thought, made an incredible point about what it must have been like to be a person of color in the crowd during the DMX set.
Yeah.
It was just like, whoa.
Shocking.
Yeah. God.
Shocking. Thousands upon thousands of young white men screaming the N-word.
Yeah.
And that's DMX did his show. So I don't know that there's any criticism for him. But I don't know. I mean, I think that's part of the problem with, and this is addressed in the documentary as well, essentially putting together a garbage rock, I don't even know what to call those bands, festival, that caters 80% to angry young white men, and then throwing some token rappers and female singer-songwriters in the middle of it.
Yeah. Look, when Creed come out looking like good guys in your story, you know what I mean?
Pretty rough, yeah. Pretty rough.
It was a rough time. It was a rough time. But as a doc, I thought this was really fantastic. And
great doc.
Honestly, it made me excited to see the other docs that are coming in this series. I thought it was really well put together. I sort of made this point earlier, but I think because it was in this pre-cell phone era, the devices that they use to kind of tell you the story of, journals from concert goers and a lot of this news
really cool
footage, seeing the MTV stuff and hearing from the MTV people it really packs a punch.
Yeah. I was a little surprised they couldn't get Carson. I have one criticism of the doc as a doc.
Okay.
Was there anyone interviewed as an expert who was not a Ringer or Grantland employee?
I think there was, but I'm having trouble recalling them in this particular moment.
Yeah. I mean, there were the concert goers, obviously, who were not associated.
You're talking about was a Ringer employee or also wasn't involved in the – like Dave Holmes is not a Ringer employee, but he's being interviewed as an MTV employee essentially, right?
Right, Right. So I'm saying they had principals, either concert goers or people who, people who were there. And then they had, culture experts, every single one of whom was at one point employed by Bill Simmons.
Yeah. Not necessarily. Right. Like Wesley Morris is not currently employed.
No, nor is Stephen Hyden. Right.
He actually did work on the podcast from which this documentary came.
Oh, OK. So, I mean, look, and don't get me wrong. Those two guys, there were a couple other experts as well that I believe had direct Bill Simmons ties. They're great experts.
And their commentary is really good.
And it's really good. So it doesn't hurt the doc. But
it's not like it's a parade of, right? It wasn't like they were like, here's 20 guys from the Ringer.
It's like three or four. But yeah. I love Bill Simmons in most ways. I love his content. I think he hit on something about the zeitgeist of pop culture consumption that is spectacular and directly touches what I am interested in. I also think he occasionally has a problem with not thinking outside of his own box. And I think sometimes when he thinks, man, I need a cultured writer of color to comment on this. He thinks, all right, who are the writers of color I've employed in the past? And I think he could do better. That's all.
Hmm. I'm not going to necessarily argue with that. I do think that this is the kind of thing he's best at. And, you know, if Music Box is going to sort of function as like a 30 for 30 for of music.
Right.
That would be tremendous.
I agree. I agree. And I hope it does. But I also hope that if we get four or five experts in each film, you know, more than half of them have not previously or currently been employed by the producer of the doc. I just think that's
care if the voices are interesting. You know what I mean? If the commentary,
and again, this is a minimal complaint, and it really, for the most part, it doesn't affect the quality of the film. Because again, Stephen Hayden and Wesley Morris, look, if you and I were producing this documentary, those might very well be the two people we went to. So it's not like it's not Joe House. You know what I'm saying? Like, I'm not saying this is nepotism, and
there was Zoe Simmons, like,
right? That would be different. And so I'm not saying that at all. I'm just saying, like, that's it. Like, it's something that I would pay attention to if I was him.
Yeah, fair enough. You know, obviously, I should disclose I'm in the tank for Hyde, and we are friends, and he's, you know, he's doing a podcast with him. So,
yeah, no, I think people know that. We've talked about that podcast on this podcast, and I love Stephen Hyde. He's one of my favorite music journalists, and I thought he brought not only tremendous insight, but as he always does, like a really, like, open-hearted, emotional reading of things that seeks to care about people. So I love Stephen Hayden. It's not a complaint about Stephen Hayden at all, or about Wesley Morris. Like, by the way, Wesley Morris, as he has progressed into middle age and really leaned into that adult man mustache, it's a really good look for him.
I was not expecting that aside. But
it's just like that mustache is a thing. You know what I mean? Like, it's a specific mustache, and it just fits perfectly on his face, and you might not have thought that previously. Anyway, they're great. I just, you know, if I was producing a documentary like this, I think I'd go out of my way to not have primarily my friends as the commentators, even if my friends were really good at it.
Maybe.
I would have just added some other people to avoid any appearance of whatever you want to call it, nepotism.
The percentage of experts, quote unquote, who are Ringer people is high, but the percentage of interviewees who are Ringer people is actually pretty low. So
I guess that's right. And again, like, maybe I shouldn't even have brought this up. It's definitely a nitpick. It's just like, you know, you make at some point in a documentary, you've got a list of all the people you're interviewing. Right. And I would guess that list is broken down into like festival attendees, you know, festival media people, you know, MTV and people who were there in an official capacity, like the security guy who was there, and then pop culture experts. And every single person under pop culture expert was at one point employed by Bill Simmons.
This is where it'd be interesting to see who was cut from this, because I'm sure
It would be really interesting. Yeah.
All right. Let's move on to Miracle Workers, which I think we can talk about pretty quick.
Yeah. I'll say everything I have to say about Miracle Workers. It's not hard. I watched both episodes. If you enjoyed the first two seasons of Miracle Workers, I don't see any reason why you would not enjoy this. It has a very similar sense of humor. It is, you know, the main joke of Miracle Workers is, boy, like, the past was pretty fucked, huh? And they do a really good job of making it funny. And the actors all play different parts in each season, but all have a similar sensibility in each season in some way. And that's all really clever. And at the end of the day, it's like the show's like a B. It's like a solid B.
Yeah. I actually felt like this season is a little less funny than the first two so far. But not in any kind of like major appreciable way.
Yeah, don't you think that's just
doesn't change your general point.
Right.
You know what I mean?
To me, I pretty much agree with that, but to me that's mostly just diminishing returns. It's not I don't know that it's less cleverly written. It's just you know, even though we're in a new setting with new characters, we're basically doing the same thing for a third time, and it's going to lose a little bit of its punch.
Yeah, no, I think that's completely right. Still worth watching.
This is one I'm definitely going to let build 4 or 5 episodes on the DVR and just blast them out.
Yeah, I think that that's probably the way to go with other things going on.
I will say, did you watch the little like behind the scenes 3-minute thing they had?
I did not.
Daniel Radcliffe said something which was fascinating to me. He was like, you know, other than Harry Potter, this is the longest working relationship I've had with people. And
I guess that's true.
Right. And like, there's not a ton to that. Different shows have longer working relationships, right? I mean, fine. But it did make me realize I hadn't thought about Harry Potter in association with Daniel Radcliffe kind of in a while. And I gotta say, like, I can't think of someone more obviously and specifically and directly associated with one very specific, huge thing who broke out of that mold so quickly and successfully.
The one counter I would have to that is I just don't know how many people who are seeing the show, you know what I mean, to think of him in this other way.
No, well, but it's not just this way. Like, he's been in a lot. He's made some odd choices. He's made some interesting choices. Yeah. And, like, it's not that I think so many people are seeing this. It's just it made me realize that when I see him, I don't see Harry Potter. I just see an actor.
Can I give you one more on this who maybe was more successful?
Yeah.
Robert Pattinson.
Yeah, maybe. Although, what's the last thing he did?
That weird ass Lighthouse movie that was like Oscar, like I think was nominated for a couple of Oscars.
I don't know what that is.
Hold on. I'll get you the name of it.
I can think. I know he did Good Time, and obviously, I think like we're about to see him as Batman, so that is going to change things.
Yeah, for sure.
But as of now, I would say
for a while now. Although it's funny when you go to his IMDb, of course, the first thing it says is still Twilight.
Right, and I'm sure Daniel Radcliffe says Harry Potter, but
it was called The Lighthouse. Sorry, it was the name of the movie.
All right, well, I never heard of that, but here's the bigger point, I think, is Radcliffe was in a bigger series that lasted longer and started when he was much younger, and I think still has sort of broken out from that at least as successfully, if not more successfully, than Pattinson.
He was, by the way, in a Harry Potter movie. I did not realize that.
Yeah, he was Cedric Diggory.
The last thing that he was in that people saw was Tenet.
There you go.
I have not seen that yet.
No, he's a good one too. He's a good one too. But like, I Daniel Radcliffe is more central and like being Harry Potter from the time you were 8 years old until the time you were like 20. That it should have been harder for him to do other stuff.
Yeah, I would. The only, you know, look, it's not a contest, really, but no, because I think it's similar things. But I would also say that Pattinson, it was a more fully, fully formed human being when he started Twilight, if that makes sense. So,
yeah,
I don't know. In some ways, that seems like it would be more difficult. But the last, maybe. I'm trying to figure out. The first Twilight was in 2008, and the last one was 12. So yeah, so it wasn't quite as long a period. I would say it's fair as well.
And also, just like, I mean, as huge as Twilight was, it can't hold a candle to Harry Potter.
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair. But they were both pretty big cultural phenomenons, I would say, specific cultural phenomenons.
No doubt. No doubt.
Yeah, no doubt. For sure. All right, let's. We got one more thing to talk about. It is McCartney 3-2-1.
Finally.
Yes, finally. You were. Are you saying that because I blew last week or because you're dying to talk about it?
Both.
All right. Well, the floor is yours.
Maybe dying to talk about it is the wrong way to put it, but just dying to say how good it is. And this is one of those things where I don't know. I'm literally too sort of overwhelmed and in love to understand whether this is actually a great show or if it's just a show perfect for me. But like,
I have a take on that.
Okay, well, let me finish why I love it first.
Okay,
before you crap on it, because I guess this is the show that you knew I was going to love, but you did not like.
I did not like at all.
I just, do you not like the Beatles?
No, it's not that I don't like the Beatles. I do like the Beatles. So I don't love the Beatles, but I like the Beatles.
For me, nothing could be more interesting than a great musician and a great producer going into tunes, breaking them apart, studying the intricacies, and telling stories. I mean, that's literally, if you could have a TV channel that was just different producers and different other great artists telling stories and breaking down their tunes and talking about them, I would watch it until I died.
Mm.
I just, it's so fascinating to me. And the things that Paul McCartney is willing to open up about with Rick Rubin, like, it's just, it's so interesting to me. When they break down, when Paul tells the story about that random chord that someone taught him that then he put into Michel Maibel and he just, like, sent a letter to a French student he knew. to get some French lyrics for one of the great love songs of all time. Like, that stuff, that's crack to me.
Yeah, see, and the reason why I think this is a you thing, I feel like, and maybe it's about it's a lot about your relationship to this music.
To music in general, but also to this music.
To this music, because I'm right there with you on, I generally love great artists sitting down and talking about music and breaking down intricacies and things all like that format. Yeah. If you told me that's what this is, and that's part of why I was excited to watch the show. And we raved about the Rick Rubin series at the time.
The docu-series about him, you mean? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Totally.
I have a lot of love for his work. I like I said, I like the Beatles. I don't have Beatles animus. But I did not think Rick Rubin was a good interviewer at all. And I honestly felt like so much of the show is like listening to your grandpa tell stories. Like, it's so all over the place. And like at times, like, not really about the point. And I felt like not insightful often. And like, I mean, like, it's the kind of thing where if you think that, like, the fact that John Lennon used to call Paul McCartney Four Eyes, or sorry, that Paul used to call John Four Eyes, and John used to call somebody, like, if you think that that's great stuff, like that you, and you're really getting to know these guys, then yeah, this is great. But to me, I'm like, this is already the most examined band of in history.
Well, you picked the most annoying story.
No, but there's so many of those kind of stories. Like, we were back in our parents with this and Ringo. We used to always have a song. We used to like to always get a song for Ringo on the album. And blah, 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 blah. And then every once in a while, yeah, you get a really interesting nugget like that Michelle one. But like, they're like, it's just interspersed between so much bullshit.
Oh,
like,
I think you're being unfair. What about the thing where they, what about when they put on While My Guitar Gently Weeps? And they were flipping back and forth between the two channels, and you like heard two totally different songs, or like the bass line on Back to the USSR. Like, I thought there were so many interesting musical parts of this. I think you're being a little
maybe
dismissive.
I don't know. I did like, I just, you know, I just did not enjoy it. I got over McCartney.
Like, do you think if this was like
McCartney one, maybe I would have been better off.
Right.
If this was
like, not granted, it's not possible. If this was George or John, do you think you would like it more? Is this a Paul McCartney thing?
I want a different band. And it's not even a, like, it's not, it's that is no shade to the Beatles' obvious greatness.
Right.
Like, or the greatness of these songs. I have ingested so much Beatles content in my life. And I'd like, let's just talk about something else. You know what I mean? It's yeah. so much content.
I mean, I know what you mean, but I do not agree.
I'm okay, man. I got it, man. These songs are like, it's, I'm not trying to take away from any of these songs, but I got it. So,
I mean, that's the other thing. I can't lie. Just part of it is, you know, I listen to the Beatles semi-regularly, but some of these songs are so fucking good. And honestly, that's another thing that is kind of mind blowing about watching this to me is like, it really does give you a sense of there. This guy is a genius on a level that is just, he's just different than normals. Like the way he talks about writing and like, oh, well, you know, that just kind of comes into my head and then this comes into my head. And then, and when he broke down, like, you know, if I'm teaching someone the piano, well, here's a chord. And if you move that chord here and transpose it up another step, and then you got six chords and now we got a song. And it's like, no, no, we don't. You do. I don't. That stuff is cool to me, even though.
I'm certainly not here to argue against the genius of Paul McCartney.
No, I know. But I think maybe part of what you're saying is like that genius is.
Prince, you would get this exact same thing. You know what I mean? Like, there are yes. other geniuses.
Oh, no, of
he's
course.
Not an unparalleled genius. You know what I mean?
No, he's a he's a unique genius and a specific genius. But no, there are other musical geniuses, of course. All I'm saying is I get a kick out of the display of that genius, full stop. And I think, it based on what I'm hearing, for you, like, when he does that, you're like, okay, you're a genius, I get it. And I'm like, oh, man, look at that guy.
Yeah. I just feel like, honestly, like, it's not even so much that, like, about whether he's a genius or not a genius. It's just like, I just feel like this is, like, you're just getting the fire hose of McCartney. You know what I mean?
And a little bit.
I want somebody to turn that into a straw. I want to sit McCartney through a straw. And I'm just getting blasted in the face with McCartney.
I will
say. You know what I mean? Right.
Here's what I would say.
It's not anything bad about McCartney.
No.
It's not even really anything bad about Rick Rubin. I am overloaded on this by this show.
Yeah. I think this show is 5 or 6 30-minute episodes, right? And I think maybe what you're essentially saying is you'd have rather seen this series with 6 1-hour episodes that were 6 different artists.
I would have definitely rather seen that 100%. Or I would have rather seen like an hour of the best of this. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, that's fair. And here's what I will say. Like, when you say Rick Rubin's not a good interviewer, I think that's right.
He produces, right? He's just sort of like letting it happen.
That's right. What he does is create like a safe space for the artist to share.
Exactly.
And I think that works
in an interview setting.
Well, I think that works in that I want to hear the artist share. And I think you're kind of saying you need someone to drive that interview so it's not just a random collection of stories.
Yeah, or someone to come along and edit it into something cohesive.
Yeah.
More cohesive. Say.
That does not – I'll say this. As much as I loved it, editing into a recognizable form or structure did not seem to be something they were interested in. So you could watch any – not just any episode of this in any order, but like sort of any cut – within the episodes in almost any order.
Yeah, I think that's right. I really was gonna hope we were gonna fight like this like we did about Schmigadoon, but I think we've now reached a place of understanding.
I don't even feel like we fought that hard about Schmigadoon. I just didn't like it.
All right, that may be true too. All right, I think that wraps up all the stuff we have for this week. I'm going to throw a surprise at you for homework that we didn't talk about in the pre-show?
Yeah, I love when you do this. Screw planning.
I have the things we planned, but we had a light one, so I'm going to just throw this one at you. And feel free to say no. I'm not trying to put you on the spot on this one.
Mm-hmm.
Because I know it's got one thing you like. It's stand-up comedy. I forget. I should know, so I apologize, but I forget where you are on Tig Notaro.
Oh yeah, I'll watch that.
But here's the thing: I didn't throw out the thing that you don't like.
No, I know about it. I'll watch it.
Oh, you know about it.
Yeah,
it's anime.
Yeah,
that's the thing. All right.
Yep.
So, but you're in on Tig Notaro drawn.
Yeah, because that's not. Yeah, that's yes.
Okay. All right, so
can I recommend an animated thing that may or may not relate to this that maybe can explain why I'd be more open to this than a standard piece of animation?
Okay.
You know who Mark Spears is?
The sports writer?
Yeah, Mark Spears, the buddy of mine.
Okay.
Really good NBA reporter, has been in that game for a long, long time, currently works for ESPN's The Undefeated, and he has been doing this.
That was a little flex there. That was good. Sorry.
What? That's what he does.
Yeah, no, not what he does, that you guys are friends. Sorry.
Oh, we're not like friends. He's a work pal. I like the guy, is all I'm saying. It's not a friend's. If it sounded like I was flexing my friendship with Mark Spears, let's take that back, because if he heard that, he'd probably be like, really? We're not that close. We know each other and we're friendly. How's that? But he has been doing what they're calling hoop stories with Mark J. Spears. And he basically just sits on a couch, and it's like the sports version of Charlie Murphy stories from the Dave Chappelle show, except instead of being acted out, it's animated.
Oh, that sounds good. And I would watch that.
Oh, it's so good. The first one is a story about Michael Jordan. They're like 3-4 minutes long, but they are so good. Because this dude, like, Spears is a guy who has made his way in the industry through relationships. So he's been in every locker room. He has some of the most incredible stories you could imagine, and seeing them animated is hilarious. The first one is about sort of about Michael Jordan's legendary sort of competitive dickishness.
Well, and it's like, you could think about how many stories in The Last Dance would have made a great cartoon, right?
Exactly. Like, exactly.
Security guard guy playing quarters was, you know what I mean? Like that became a great meme, but it would have been an incredible cartoon as well, right?
So. It's like that, except it's about it's a dude he knows who used to play for North Carolina, and it's a story about Michael Jordan like coming back to visit, basically.
All right. That sounds great. I will try to check that out.
Hoop Stories with Mark J. Spears, and that is why I'm totally willing to watch.
All right. Drawn. Take the target drawn.
Yeah.
All right. Behind the Music is back on Paramount Plus.
Yeah, man.
I'm fired up for this for reasons that we have now discussed. So I think you get on this. There's also a show called Good on Paper. This was a Kolsky recommendation.
It's a movie.
Movie? Sorry, movie. Excuse me.
Eliza Schlesinger, stand-up comedian. She made a rom-com.
Oh, man. I totally, when you said Eliza Schlesinger rom-com, I was totally thinking of Elijah Dushku.
Oh, hopefully this is more interesting than that would have been.
Yeah. Okay. All right. I'm in on that.
I mean, like Eliza Dushku, but I think her rom-com days are probably past.
I would guess they are. Sadly, that's, you know, so not sadly in like the we're being robbed of great Eliza Dushku rom-coms, but you know what I mean. Like,
I mean, she's my age, basically. You know,
right? You don't get to be in romantic comedies in your 40s, right?
Yeah, like that's just kind of a bummer. But yeah, she's my age, and you know, people my age, no one wants to see us in love.
Make out, yeah. Yeah, it's not good. all right. Sorry. I say that being older than you.
Yeah. No, hey, look, this is the aging process. We're living it.
This is what happens. And then the other thing we're going to check out is Dr. Death on Peacock. That is Joshua Jackson, Christian Slater, and Alec Baldwin.
Yeah.
And some decent things about it. So.
A star-studded cast and a pretty upsetting story, as I understand it.
Yeah, I think the doctor does some bad stuff.
Yeah,
maybe it is based on true story. Yeah, so we'll see what's happening there. Joshua Jackson playing like a supervillain. Whatever, I'm into that. I mean, obviously not a supervillain, but you know.
Yeah, I think I would be more into Joshua Jackson actually playing a supervillain, but we'll see.
You may get that someday. Who knows?
Look, at this rate, there's a decent chance of everyone playing a supervillain at some point.
Right. There's a lot of opportunity out there on the supervillain front. Yep. All right.
Look, The Boys is coming back for another season. It's filled with supervillains. Let's go. Yeah.
But you, Boys, Emmy nominated for Best Drama, The Boys.
Yeah, man.
Yeah, so you know that one's going to be back. All right, I think that that pretty much wraps it up for this week. There's also a ton of fantastic, interesting sports content this week. So if you're enjoying that, enjoy that. And
So this week,
real far from the challenge.
Yeah, just a couple weeks from the challenge, but just this week alone, we've got Olympic action, we've got the NBA draft, we've
fired
got
up for that draft.
The Major League Baseball trade deadline. It is lit in the sports world, so that'll be something we get into next week as well.
All right, sounds good.
Bye.
This game's in the Admiral refrigerator. The door is closed. The light's out. Butter's getting hard. The eggs are cooling, and the Jell-O is jiggling.
So long, everybody.
And do me a favor. Have yourself a tremendous evening.